The Tom Woods Show, episode 1109.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, get yourselves an excellent shave at an outstanding price with Harry's and get your $13 trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. It is such a pleasure to welcome Guido Holzman to the show. He is the great biographer of Ludwig von Mises. The book in question, of course, is Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism, an astonishing book, wonderful book. He's the author of other books as well. I'm particularly fond of his book, The Ethics of Money Production. There's no book quite like that one, so probably at some point I'll have to get him back to talk about that. But Guido is an extraordinarily accomplished scholar. He's a professor at the University of Angers in France, where, of course, he teaches in French. He speaks German natively and learned English at a later age. And it's interesting, the one time, my understanding of the story is the one time he had an opportunity to meet Murray Rothbard, he recalls that his English at that time was quite halting. And so he didn't have quite the conversation that he wanted to have. And now his English is so beautiful, it makes me feel embarrassed, the way he can deliver a scholarly lecture so elegantly and with just the right word choice. He puts native English speakers absolutely to shame. So he's just a brilliant, brilliant guy. Really one of the top people we have, I think, especially if you read his scholarly work in the journals, like in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, for example, you know you are reading something by, in my opinion, one of the genuine greats we have today. So today we're going to talk about Mises' life, and in particular we thought, I said, what's a manageable slice of Mises' life that we could talk about? He said, what about Mises in 1918? And that's a rather significant year, so we thought we would do that. Guido, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
I had to wait till episode 1109 to have you on so that people wouldn't think that all the fun was behind us, you know, that we had, what more could he produce for us? He's already had all the wonderful people on. I held you off until episode 1109 just to say to those naysayers,
well,
right?
Tom, I guess you didn't find an American who would volunteer for a 9/11 show.
Indeed. Well, listen, let's talk about Mises 100 years ago. It's 2018. We can talk about Mises in 1918. I asked, just so everybody knows, I asked Guido, what is a manageable chunk of Mises' life we could talk about? And he said, what about Mises in and around 1918? Okay, it's 100 years later. That makes perfect sense. And of course, 1918 is a fairly momentous year in European history.
Right.
But before we do that, why don't we just briefly say something about Mises in 1912? Because who Mises was in 1918 has a lot to do, no doubt, with a major work he produced in 1912, which in English is translated as The Theory of Money and Credit, although I know you prefer the translation The Theory of Money and Fiduciary Media.
That's right.
But can you possibly take a minute, I know it's silly to say a minute, but to explain what was groundbreaking, I mean, other than I know the incorporation of marginal utility theory into monetary theory, but that I don't want to get too far afield with technical stuff. From the layman's point of view, what's groundbreaking about that work?
Mises put the classical theory of money and of monetary policy on a completely new foundation. And the revolution had already occurred with Smith and Ricardo in a way, right? Because they had argued that a nation could not grow rich by manipulating the money supply, right? The classical philosophers hadn't thought differently about this matter. And the medieval theologians also, right? So it's the same thing. I mean, all prime intellectuals had never thought that by just printing more money tickets or something like this, you could make a nation richer. At the time of Adam Smith, so the 18th century or so, for about 200 or 300 years, merchants and national governments had completely reversed this. So they had the established practice of very strong monetary interventionism. And to justify this, which, as Austrian economists, of course, we know the reason, right, the rationale of this, because you can enrich yourself and your friends by increasing the money supply and by spending the new tickets first, right? You benefit from what we call the Cantillon effect. That is the redistribution of real income to the benefit of the first users and the expense of the later better ones. Now, so they've been doing this, but in order to justify this, of course, you cannot go ahead and say, well, we want to enrich ourselves at your expense. So they had to come up with all kinds of cookie arguments to make their case. And these arguments had become very important in the 18th century, most notably the argument that the government should intervene in the money supply by trade policy, right? By increasing export premia and so on, by granting export monopolies, and all the, so you can promote the export of merchandise, thereby inducing more metal to flow into your country. And on the other hand, you can hamper imports through taxes and tariffs and so on, thereby preventing the outflow of metal to other countries, right? So the idea was that through trade policy, you can increase the amount of money circulating within your own borders and thereby benefiting the nation as a whole, because more money would be spent. Now, Adam Smith had come along and trashed the entire argument, because he showed that not only, you cannot grow rich by increasing the money supply, but actually those policies which are supposed to benefit the nation are actually harming it, because they channel capital away from those areas where they would be most usefully be deployed from the point of view of the country as a whole. And then the other classical economists had reinforced this, especially David Ricardo. But of course, their entire argument had two major problems. One was the scientific foundation in value theory, because you have the cost of production theory of prices. And then on the other hand, the classical economists had not really come to grips with modern conditions of money production, that is, production of money through commercial banks, right? So the whole fractional reserve business, it didn't have a firm grip on this. And then especially also the vexed question of fiat money, right? Is fiat money beneficial because it would allow cost savings, right? You can replace a more expensive type of money, say gold or silver, by paper tickets. And are there? Is it not also beneficial because you can increase credit indefinitely? And so these were the questions that the classical economists had not really come to grips with, not very thoroughly. What Mises did in his book was to address all of these questions systematically, based on Karl Menger's new subjective marginal value theory. That was his main contribution, right? So you have a completely new edifice of monetary thought that reconfirms, right, the insights of the classical philosophers, of the medieval theologians, of the classical economists, but based on top-notch value theory and a very penetrating analysis of everything related to modern money and banking. Now, that was more than 1 minute.
But that was about as good a summary of what I asked for as anyone could have hoped for. All right. So in that case, let's now fast forward to 1918, or maybe let's just fast forward to World War One.
Yeah.
Because you have in Mises' The Last Night of Liberalism, you have a pretty good discussion here of this period and of Mises' involvement in and opinions about World War One.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about what exactly Mises was doing during the war years and what his opinions of it were? Apparently he had been expecting a world war for a number of years. Apparently he was cursed with the ability to see negative events in the future.
Yeah, certainly. Well, he was not an optimist, right? But in all fairness, it must be said that the war was hanging in the air, right? So many people, I mean, even in the average population, had anticipated this, right? And it was an inevitable outgrowth of the reigning philosophy of nationalism and chauvinism and so on, in which held that you could aggrandize the power and the welfare of your own nation by carrying out victorious wars against others and so on. Well, Mises had dreaded this, of course. As a classical liberal, he knew very well that war is not a source of wealth, right? It's a motor of destruction in all respects, and so he did not go happily into the war. Right. So, but still, as a patriot, so he assumed his duties and said, "Well, so we have to defend the country. We have barbarians at the gate." He never had very high opinions of Russians. So this shows through in all of his writings. So he thought that Russians conceived them as some sort of an antipode of Western civilization. And he certainly had the desire to protect his country against Russian invasion, right? So in World War One, you had three main war theaters, right? So there was the Eastern Front, which from the point of view of the of Austria-Hungary was a northern front with Russia. And you had the Western Front, and then as from May 1915, you had also the Southern Front, where Austria confronted the Italians. Now, Mises had, if I remember this correctly, had three stints at the front. He spent the first year in war from August 1914 through September 1915. On the what was the Austrian Northern Front, so the Eastern Front, and this was really the greatest hell of the entire war. I mean, much has been written about Verdun and the horrors of the Western Front and so on, but the Western Front was comparatively quiet during most of the war, right? Because there were the trenches and so on. Verdun was an exception, whereas on the Eastern Front, I mean, it was just a massacre all over the place, and it related to a war strategy, because the whole point of the Austrian army was to keep the to bind the Russian forces in the plains of northern Galicia, you know, so they couldn't hide in the mountains, because then the Russians could have thrust their whole army into the northern plains of Germany, which was to be prevented. So they, the Austrians had to get out of the mountains and fight them in the plains. So this this involved heavy losses, and it was just terrible. And Mises then returned to Vienna. He had some job at the war ministry as an economic consultant. And he returned then later on to the Northern Front again. I think it was a year later, in December of 1916, when Romania had entered the war. So the Austrian forces occupied Romania. And then again, a few months later, in May of 1917, he participated in the 12th Battle of the Isonzo, which is a river in northern Italy, today northern Italy. So at the time was a border river with Austria-Hungary, and was also a victory of the Austrian forces. And then he definitely returned to Vienna in December of 1917 to a bureaucrat job at the war ministry, and which allowed him also to resume his activities as a lecturer, as a private lecturer at the University of Vienna. And then in May 1918, he was actually nominated to the rank of extraordinary professor, right, which was an unpaid adjunct professor, we would say today, right? But on the level of a full professor. So this just as an overview, right? So three stints in the war, he somehow miraculously survived, but could continue his intellectual activities also during the war.
After the war was over, in his subsequent writing, I'm curious about two things. What did he have to say about the war, whether about the particulars of the war or about the general principles that lead to war, anything having to do with that? And secondly, did he take any position on the question of war guilt?
Well, so the book to read is his 1919 book, right, Nation, State, and Economy, which is one of his most underrated publications, but it's of great historical interest. So those who really want to know Mises' analysis of the problems relating to a war economy and his views about the origin of the war, well, they find much precious information in this book, probably more so than even in his correspondence or something like this. Mises identified a nationality problem, right? So the problem of mixed populations in given territories as the origin of the war. So he had a fascinating first chapter on what we could call the political economy of nations, right? The political economy of language communities in the first part of the book. And so there's also a historical abstract which he explains that, well, the origin of the war is to be seen in the bourgeois revolutions of 1848, right? And then in particular, the Germans, the German liberals, did not have the right recipes to confront the problems of the eastern territories, where you have mixed populations, where you have Germans and Czechs. Russians, and so on. So the only way they could conceive of a solution of the problem was to impose German culture, German language on all of these populations. And this could not fail to antagonize these other populations. So this is the origin of the war, right? The antagonism, because you have the conception that the way you run the country is by a monolithic, monopolistic government imposing the same kind of institutions, most notably education, instruction, and so on, everywhere. And thus creating conflicts where in a truly libertarian or classical liberal spirit, you would have granted autonomy to individuals and communities as far as possible so that they could organize themselves peacefully next to one another. So this, according to him, is the origin of the war. Then he has very interesting things to say about the economic organization of the war. In this book and in a few other publications that followed World War I up to the 1930s, he would insist, well, that actually in a war, that's when you need the free market most, right? And of course, the governments, they try to do exactly the opposite, right? Governments were imbued with their own self-importance, and so their own ideology would drive them to adopt socialistic policies, which eventually also prevailed as from 1916 onward and so on. But what they should have done is exactly the opposite, namely let the free market operate and respond flexibly and efficiently to the changing needs in a war economy, right? So thereby you could have benefited from rapid technological innovation and also capital accumulation and capital investment for the production of those goods which are needed most, right? Military equipment, cannons, and or communication system, and so on. And he gives a couple of examples, especially of the first war months, which he had, witnessed personally on the front, where he says, well, the Germans and the Austrians had gained a great technical superiority on the Eastern Front in the spring of 1915, spring and summer of 1915. And the reason was that at that point, they had at home preserved a free economy. So the entrepreneurs were free to operate, relatively free to operate anywhere as compared to Russia, could dramatically increase the equipment in quality and in quantity of the Austrian army relative to the Russians. And this brought a decisive turn of events at that point. And then later on, they were losing this advantage as from 1916 onward, when war socialism swayed first the German army and then also the Austro-Hungarian one.
I feel compelled to ask you a question that's not strictly related to 1918. In 1918, would you say it is, just a quick answer to this, would you say that to all appearances, Mises has a promising future, either within academia or elsewhere? He's a fairly respected scholar and so on. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, so, but yet in 1948, that's not so much the case. Now, obviously, a lot of things can happen in 30 years, but how does this promising young intellectual go from the world is his oyster to being very much in the shadows?
Well, I mean, 1948, Mises was in the U.S., and he was, at that point, then almost 70 years old. Right? He was in his late 60s, not at all the same thing.
All right, so let's think the late, let's say 1940, because 1940, he would have been 59.
Yeah.
And you still have a lot in you as an academic at 59. You should.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. So Mises comes to the U.S., and it's true. I mean, the doors do not flung open wide open to receive him with a very warm welcome, right? So not on the same level of a standing that he had in Europe. Right, but let's say, I mean, anyway, it's different. It's difficult anyway for any immigrant, especially in those days, right? The interaction between the different academic communities were not as strong as they are, for example, today, right? So they didn't have emails and so on. They had occasional conferences, he would take part in them, but you had rather cloistered academic communities in the U.S. and in Europe. Mises was known in the U.S., but of course he was he was old and he was out of fashion with his views. Right, he was a classical liberal in the years of the Roosevelt administration. This was not a plus. And then, most importantly, his views on the what economic science was all about, right? So the methodological, epistemological views were completely out of tune with what all other people thought, not only in economics, but also in the other social sciences, right? Especially in America, there was the view that the social science, in order to be real sciences, would have to mimic or, let's say, apply the same methods that had made their proof in the natural sciences. And Mises certainly did not do this.
Let's talk about Mises' fortunes, though, back in 1918. He ultimately is able to teach at the University of Vienna, but under the monarchical regime, he had some success in this area. But then, apparently, in the period of the Republic, not so much success. What changed and why should that be?
Yeah, the precise circumstances elude me also somewhat, right? I mean, Herbert Berkofler might tell us more about this, and Eugen Schulak, who have this wonderful book about the early history of the Austrian school. My impression from reading the literature was that under the Republic, there was a more popular stream that that gained importance, which was dominated also by some very strong anti-Semitic attitudes. So Jewish professors, with a few exceptions, such as Hans Kelsen, had greater difficulties making their way in postwar academia. There was one important example would be that Fritz Machlob, right, had difficulties getting a habilitation. So he was blocked for several years, eventually got a habilitation degree under Mises, could not find a position there, and many other Jewish economists couldn't find a position in Austria. Oskar Morgenstern, who later made a great career in the U.S., he was a professor at Princeton and so on, couldn't find a place in Austrian academia, so he had to become the director of this very small outfit that Mises had created in 1927, the Austrian Business Psycho Research Institute. Hayek was the first director of this institute, so he too, as a classical liberal, had difficulties finding his place in Austrian academia, even though the number of positions within the country had increased. Right, so in many respects, Mises had the best of the old monarchy, the old Danubian monarchy, in the last year of the war, amazingly. Right? So I think 1918 was a very good year for him, despite the war context. Right? He also, in Vienna, he met Max Weber in the spring. Weber had taught in the summer semester at the University of Vienna. The two of the men became friends. Weber certainly spent many hours discussing with Mises, and then in his great book, Economy and Society, he stated that of all monetary doctrines, the ones of Mises was the most respectable or the most agreeable from his point of view. So it was a great compliment that he paid to the young scholar. And then let's not forget also that Mises, in those months, so in the spring, summer, and fall of 1918, well, he started developing what later turned out to be his critique of socialism and especially his economic calculation argument. So he presented this in January 1919 in a lecture to the Economic Society in Vienna. So he argued for the first time that socialism cannot work, it's not a possible economic system because it cannot rely on market prices for factors of production.
Well, let me ask you this. I know it's pretty obvious that Mises was out of step with the profession by 20, 30 years later, but where was he in relation to what we might call the economics profession in 1918? Surely not everybody would have been an Austrian, but the Austrians wouldn't have been viewed as troglodytes the way they are today in many circles. So how does he fit into the profession? Is there a lot that he has to say with which many people are in sympathy?
Yeah, I think Mises was very well respected as a monetary theorist, right? Especially then as the hyperinflations in Austria and in Germany confirmed many of the things that on a theoretical level he had developed in his book. right? And then he had the 1924 second edition of this money book, in which he went through these catastrophic monetary experiences in more detail and explained how they were fully in tune with this monetary theory. So yes, he was very well respected, but he was considered more as a technician, right? When we think of Mises today, we say he was also great monetary theorist, but he's especially the person who wrote Human Action, right? He is this intellectual who has this encyclopedic knowledge of economics and who has this systemic thought, right? So this is how we see him as a great teacher of all of economics. At the time, I think how his contemporaries saw him was more as a specialist, as a technician, as far as monetary and banking questions are concerned. The great economist the general economist who dominated the scene in Vienna and who was best known also abroad was Friedrich von Wieser, right, who had a very different approach to Mises as far as value theory is concerned, right? It's an offspring of Menger as well, but it's in all practical respects, it's diametrically opposed to what Mises considered to be true.
All right, we're going to continue this awesome conversation after we hear from a sponsor I am very proud to feature. Folks, this week in New York City, I am visiting my old friend Michael Malice, who is a frequent guest of this show. And when I was looking for a gift to get for him, I got him Harry's Razors, which, of course, are the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. And he loved it. I got him the Super Deluxe set. And in fact, when he flew down to Orlando for the 1,000th episode of the show, he brought his Harry's Razors with him. And why not? There are a lot of things to love about Harry's. The closeness of the shave, which is what I like most about it, but also the comfortable glide, the inexpensive price. Well, Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades, they'll give you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/woods, just pay for shipping. That's a $13 value that includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Rise up against overpriced blades. Get your free trial set by going to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. I was just thinking to myself, what else do I want to ask Guido about this? And I realized, wait a minute. You wrote a gigantic biography of Mises that could have been much larger, by the way, right? You had a lot of extra material too.
That's right.
And it's one that Bob Higgs gave a review to that I think if I ever received a review like that, I would feel like I could just end my career happily, feeling like I had accomplished something of real, lasting, enduring value. I have rarely come across a review as glowing and extraordinary as the one that Bob gave you for that book. It really, really was great.
Yeah, he was very generous.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful. But that was a very long, difficult slog. And obviously, we needed somebody who spoke German and could read German. Well, we got that. We need somebody who knows economics and really well and knows different schools of thought and can situate Mises within important debates and can explain the significance of what Mises was saying, not just what he was saying, which is challenging enough for some people, but why it matters, where he represents a break from the past and where he represents continuity. You were able to do all of this in this work. And I guess I just need to ask you to comment about the experience of devoting so much of your life to writing about the life and thought of this man. Did you learn anything about him in the research that was significant that you hadn't known before? Did you wind up more impressed with him than you were before? Any insight from that process, I would love to hear.
Well, Tom, I learned a lot of things. It was really a very formative experience for me. I learned a lot of Mises. I learned a lot of his thought. I learned a lot about history of economics, the history of Europe, the history of Austria-Hungary. I learned a lot of things. It was really so much. If I had known all the things that I would have to learn before setting out to this, probably I would have declined the offer, right, to write this the Mises biography, because it was a work that was commissioned by the Mises Institute, right, and Lou Rocco raised funds for this to make this possible. So I was happy to do it, but happy out of ignorance. Right. But then, of course, after the fact, so now it's done and so on. Yeah, of course, I'm happy that I did it. I would have been too lazy to do it on my own initiative, out of my own drive. Yeah, but definitely I learned a lot of things about economics. I learned a lot of things about Mises. I have been an admirer of Mises when I started off doing this, because Mises was the one who turned me into an Austrian, who brought me to the Austrian school. It was when I had studied the theory of money and credit that I became an Austrian, not because of Menger, not because of Hayek, not because even of Human Action or something like that. It was this book really that turned me around. So, but then learning more about Mises certainly increased this admiration, right? A man who, with these intellectual achievements, these endurance across many decades, a great enthusiasm for science, for civilization, for everything that springs from the culture of reason that he loved, well, is very impressive, right? So this alone, and then this went along with. Often you have people who have great intellectual achievements, but as on the personal level are rather deceiving. And in the case of Mises, what we see is great modesty. So he didn't brag about any of the things that he did personally. Actually, he tried to hide as much as possible his personal life from any attention. He destroyed a lot of material that would have shown us much more about the person. But especially from the material that survived accidentally, that he couldn't get his hand on and so on, we see a man who is really also very admirable on a personal level. He has absolute integrity, has great honesty, there's actually a great tenderness and great love for those who are close to him, great respect for those who are dependent on him, and even if he doesn't share their opinions, sometimes they have antagonistic opinions of their own colleagues and so on, he still feels the need to protect them where he can, and lives the love of their neighbor, right? Even though he was not a Christian. So he's really a very impressive person who was is a model not only as a scholar but also on a personal level. So very inspiring also.
Yeah, I'm so interested in him, and I'd love to be able to talk to you more about Mises in later years during the periods that most of us are more familiar with him, because I'm also interested in, we'll talk about this another time, but his relationship with Rothbard, given that obviously Rothbard was a devoted disciple of Mises and loved him and respected him more than you can possibly imagine, but at the same time, they did have some differences in economics, not very many and not very great, but they did have some differences in political thought,
right,
and questions like that, but also in style. I can't imagine Mises writing some of the pieces that Rothbard would have written, like in the libertarian form and so on. So I don't know, maybe you could just take a minute, then I'll let you go, but can you just give me a taste of that, of what that relationship was like, given their radically different styles that they had, personal styles?
Yeah, I think Mises probably would not have been bent on spending all of his time with clones, right? He certainly did not want to produce people who were like him, or to produce disciples who were like him, especially because he was happy to find himself in agreement with other intelligent human beings. And Rothbard definitely was a very intelligent young economist. So Mises was happy to see Rothbard build on the foundations that he himself laid, and correct the foundations where it was necessary and so on, which is exactly what he himself had done. Right? So Mises was not looking for harmony, agreement on all levels, right? So he was very tolerant also of people who did not share his view, but he still could enrich his own life on a personal level and also intellectually, right? So sometimes you derive greater stimulus from people who disagree with you than from people who do agree with you. One important example would be Haberler, right? So Gottfried von Haberler, Mises always considered him to be some sort of a social democrat, so a lefty in politics, but he still had the greatest respect for him and also personal affinity. Haberler was his wedding witness. Right, so which says something, and Mises knew that Haberler was not quite on the same page as far as economics is concerned. They had some rather muscular exchange on certain questions in the years preceding, but that didn't diminish in any way his esteem for Haberler, and would frequent him also in private life very closely. What he couldn't stand was dishonesty, unfaithfulness, and here the prime example would be Machlup, right? Machlup without any good reason, out of pure opportunistic motives. That's how Mises saw it, right? Dropped the defense of the gold standard and of sound money and adopted a more flexible, unprincipled stance in questions of monetary policy. Now, that's not a big deal, finally. In Mises' wife, Margaret, she felt that her husband's reaction was excessive. But really, I think Mises was very strongly disappointed by Machlup's behavior, and so this is something that he couldn't stand. Right? So he could very well live with people who are different orientations, different sensibilities, and so on, who have completely different viewpoints with him on economics, but there were certain prerequisites that had to be given, especially honesty, faithfulness, loyalty on a personal level, and so on, which he certainly found with not only with Habila, but also with Rothbard, Percy Greaves, and Hazlitt, and many other people.
Well, the book is Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism. You're just going to love reading it. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1109. I think you can probably read it for free at the Mises Institute.
That's correct.
Electronically. Yeah.
That's
but
correct.
I think you'd be crazy not to get the hardback version of this.
Actually, it's really a nice piece of art. They did a very good job.
Oh, no doubt. But I mean, I want to hold a hefty book like this in my hands and be able to flip through. I'm high tech on some things and very low tech on others. And when it comes to books, I have a reader for airplanes, but because it's hard to lug around like George Reisman's book, let's say, on an airplane. But I still would rather flip through. But whatever medium you use, you are going to get an awful lot out. You're not just going to get the details of Mises' life, although you will get that. You will get an extraordinary intellectual history as well, and you will learn a lot about the history of economic thought, and you'll learn a lot about economics while reading the inspiring story of a truly great man. So there's no way you can go wrong with this book. Guido, thanks so much for your time today. I'm very glad to have you in the United States for a good chunk of this year.
Yes. So I'll be here until August.
Are you coming to the conference this month at the Mises Institute?
I will go to the Austrian Economics Research Conference in Auburn, Alabama, from March 22nd to 25th. And then I will stay at the Mises Institute for the entire month of June and July.
Oh, well, that is going to be great. All right. Well, I hope I'll have some time to see and chat with you. Thanks so much again.
My pleasure, Tom.
All right, everybody. That's our episode. If you are enjoying the show, well, consider becoming a supporting listener. You get many, many benefits, not least of which is membership in my secret Facebook group, of which you have heard what you think to be legends, but turn out to be indeed all too true. Check it out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.